My name is Charles Wessner. I've been in touch with many of you, as have some of my colleagues. We're very grateful that you're willing to come here today. Everything is perfectly aligned. We're simply trying to coordinate a senator's schedule and a congresswoman's schedule to begin our meeting. So you should wish ourselves collective luck. But Senator Udall's staff tell us that they are at 17th and Constitution and closing, so we expect them here shortly. This building is just to remind you that you're actually at the National Academy of Sciences. If you intended to be at the State Department, you should cross the street. We may be able to have a glass of wine on that terrace tonight, depending on what the weather does. I work with the board on science, technology, and economic policy. The goal of our board's activity is to better understand the scientific and technological elements affecting the competitiveness of the United States. One of the things that we try and work on is how do you take the great research investment we make in this country and use it to help accelerate innovation and advance the competitiveness of our country. We convene workshops with experts like many of you here today. To a surprising extent, at least to us surprising, often the executive branch and the Congress follow the recommendations that we make. That, of course, is very gratifying. At the same time, it puts some pressure on you to get it right. One of the things that we do to get it right is to ask, when I used to work in IT, you know, as a last resort, IT specialists will ask the users what they need rather than inform them what works best. And there's a tendency often in the government to do that without asking industry what would actually work. One of the other things that distinguishes the work of the STEP Board is that, as you know, here in Washington, we are very focused on the global economy. This involves talking to each other inside the Beltway with very little attention to what is going on around the world. And the good news is that we're one of the leading centers of analysis in looking at what other countries are doing. And we do this in a collaborative way because it is beneficial to the world community that we innovate faster and better. And as you can see from this list of books, and by the way, these books are all free. You can take whatever you would like. Within reason, we'd prefer that you take copies, not the entire box. You'll find that the Japanese have major efforts underway in terms of changing their innovation system. India has made remarkable progress. And as the last meeting, for those of you who are here in April, Flanders, a region that is about half of Belgium, has innovative programs as well. Particularly IMEC, the Inter-University Microelectronics Cooperative. So there are things to learn from them, and we're making an effort to do so. So what we're trying also to do is to learn about best practice in state and regional initiatives. You know, particularly over the last decade, there's been a surge in state activity, some of it quite innovative. And I'm always a little bit bemused when we talk at the federal level about cluster development. The federal government can certainly help, can instigate, can encourage, but clusters, by definition, are clustered locally. And things like local leadership are important and not something that is easy to mandate from Washington. In the area we're talking about today, there are very significant synergies between state and federal government initiatives. Some of the leading initiatives that you might want to look at are examples are Arizona, where there's been major activities, although I would point out that some of their major activities concern getting funding from the Department of Energy. In the same way, Ohio has a growing cluster, more than many people realize. I have to confess that I thought First Solar was a classic California firm. And it may be, but somehow it seems that the production is all in around Toledo, Ohio, something that I'm not sure is fully understood here in the corridors of power. And of course, Colorado, as you, we will no doubt hear from the senator, has a very active program. So the key challenge that we're trying to talk about today, different from many places in the in this town and certainly different from many places in the academy, is we want to talk about how we can bring the technologies we have, the technologies we know, forward into the marketplace. Our focus is on what do we need to accelerate the innovation, what do we need to do to actually deploy. Now, one way of doing that, and hence the title of the meeting, is partnering. And we were blessed to have a Gordon Moore, whom I would expect that many of you are, would recognize, to spend a number of years developing a 10-volume set looking at different types of partnerships in the United States. And the basic conclusion from our finding is that these partnerships are extremely effective. They include innovation awards, they include R&D consortia that we're going to talk about, they include science and technology parks. And for those of you, and there may be some who like to stick your nose up in the air about science and technology parks, it's time to get real. The rest of the world is using them as very effective tools. When we were in Shanghai recently, we started to drive across one of the parks, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove. And after a while, I began to think that this is a little different park than what we've seen elsewhere. Massive investments that are very effective tools. The good news is that we have actually a successful track record. And here I'd like to speak a little bit to some of the congressional staff and the DOD staff that are with us. In the 1980s, we took a number of initiatives that resulted in us having what we call today a semiconductor industry. If we had not taken initiatives with the semiconductor trade agreement, with Semitech, many of these initiatives coming out of the thoughts from the Semiconductor Research Corporation, which had been established earlier, we might well not have the industry we have today. And one of my sources for that is a fellow called Gordon Moore, who we think knows a good bit about this. One of the key questions is, when we develop this industry, is how do we keep the industry here? How do we capture the benefits of the stimulus and our rising R&D budgets in the United States? How do we address the locational competition, which is a reality, a healthy reality, I would point out, but one that we have to recognize? And the answer, we think, is to use proven innovation partnerships wherever possible that will bring U.S.-based, and we say U.S.-based, not U.S.-owned, firms together to work in clusters. And a key element in that is supporting both the large, the medium, and the small-sized companies. This is not something that can be reserved just for the big players, nor should it be reserved just for small players. So today's conference is going to look at the programs that we have in place, identify opportunities where additional DOE investments or NSF investments could be useful, see what collaborative efforts can be taken, and explore the prospects for cooperative R&D. And I'd also like to stress the standards. I was asked on Capitol Hill recently whether NIST would have any role in energy, and I was really quite taken aback by that because, as somebody pointed out, if we have a problem with drywall that has been imported from one country in Florida, I would certainly hope that we don't have similar problems with solar cells as we go forward. So we look forward to a lively and constructive discussion. Many of you have come a long way. We're very pleased to have you. We'd also like to thank our sponsors who have been generous in their support to make these activities possible. I'd now like to introduce Clark McFadden, a committee member, and a leading figure in helping to assemble this discussion today.
Good morning. I'm Clark McFadden, a member of the STEP committee that is sponsoring the session this morning. On behalf of the committee and our chair, Mary Good, I'd like to add my welcome to you on what promises to be a very stimulating session. This is one in a series of sessions that the committee has sponsored, addressing, among other things, the theme of creating and sustaining clusters of technology development and manufacturing. These clusters have proven to be very successful in generating jobs, growth, and productivity, things that are in high demand these days. They are a central target of state and regional innovation programs. Recently, the National Academy of Engineering identified making solar energy more economical as one of today's grand challenges for engineering. We are here to focus on partnerships for photovoltaic manufacturing. Photovoltaics has long been the subject of financial engineering, project loan guarantees, subsidies, tariff infeeds, and the like. Today, we are concentrating on what I would call technology engineering. How do we structure, facilitate, and leverage the collaborative or partnering aspects of technology development for manufacturing of photovoltaics? Successful technology partnering has many elements. It begins with sharing experience and information, jointly assuming risks, and ultimately being measured by the commercial market. There are many dimensions to successful technology partnering. Assessing technology obstacles, gaps, and opportunities, something that can often encompass road mapping and standard setting. Sponsoring research by others through the provision of financial support, technical guidance, and performance evaluation. Undertaking directly collaborative research in its many forms. This can involve government agencies and laboratories, universities, nonprofits, and, of course, industry itself. Transferring technology so that it can be effectively commercialized. This is critical to any manufacturing effort and has always characterized the most successful technology partnering ventures. And providing demonstration facilities or foundries to validate improvements in manufacturing equipment and materials and processes. All of these dimensions can contribute to a successful technology partnering, and all of them are relevant to our agenda today. We have many constituencies represented here who have a strong interest in successful technology partnering for photovoltaic manufacturing. Many in the senior leadership of the Department of Energy are here with us to share their ideas and ambitions for photovoltaic manufacturing. This is a very healthy and welcome trend. They have a national mission to promote photovoltaic energy and an urgency to implement new initiatives. Congressional members and staff are also present as they craft legislation to move the nation forward in photovoltaic manufacturing. Indeed, the Senate report for the 2010 Appropriations Act recommends that the Department of Energy establish photovoltaic manufacturing initiatives reflecting input from these very National Academy workshops. Leaders of the photovoltaic industry, both device manufacturers and equipment and material suppliers, are here with us today. We also have representatives from several of the most successful collaborative ventures in technology development and manufacturing from other industries, in particular the semiconductor industry. Many of these are actually currently engaged in photovoltaic technology and manufacturing activities. These institutions have a proven track record in collaborative efforts in technology development and support for manufacturing. Finally, there are representatives from state and regional governments who are most eager to attract and promote clusters of technology development and manufacturing in photovoltaics. With such knowledgeable and highly qualified participants, we expect to have a very substantive and provocative session here today. And it's my privilege to introduce our first speaker who will provide us with the initial address this morning, Senator Mark Udall of Colorado. And from the perspective of solar energy and the solar industry, we couldn't ask for a better representative in the Senate. Indeed, for decades, he and his family have been associated with sunshine. After graduating from Williams College, Senator Udall moved to Colorado, where he served in local and state government. He then served five terms in the House of Representatives, where he developed a distinguished record on energy and environmental issues. He currently serves on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where he's a highly effective advocate for renewable energy and the green energy economy. He has demonstrated a clear understanding of the connections between preserving and expanding American jobs and manufacturing, establishing energy security and independence, and combating climate change. His legislative efforts have emphasized incentives for green technologies, jobs, and companies, investments in infrastructure and the smart grid, while also pushing for a national renewable energy standard as part of a comprehensive approach to energy policy that addresses critical national needs. Senator Udall, we look forward to your remarks. Thank you.
That's great. Well, good morning. Thank you, Clark, for that nice introduction. And Clark and I just compared notes. He's a graduate of Williams College as well. And I think he probably was admitted on a different basis than I was. I was a resident of Arizona. They had a quota system for Arizonans. There were only two Arizonans that attended Williams College. They thought we were an unusual species. I couldn't get admitted today, I'm sure, but it was a wonderful time in my life, having a chance to live in New England and learn from that part of our wonderful country. But thanks again for that great introduction. I had heard about the event today, and I was excited because I understood I was going to come over here and listen to Dr. Chu, and the next thing I knew, they'd substituted me in for Dr. Chu. So you've got a Nobel Prize winner who didn't show up, and you now have got a broken-down mountain climber from Colorado who will address you here for a few minutes on the important work you're undertaking today. Maybe I get a little more credibility. I do have a 3.5-kilowatt system on my house in Boulder. We were doing very, very well in our net energy use until my two children came home this summer, and I think we're falling behind now. I've seen those kilowatt hours increase, but we're going to continue to do our part as individuals. That is my wife and I. And I think that's part of my message more broadly is, look, each and every one of us can make a difference as we face this challenge, but I think real opportunity with energy policy, energy technologies, and our energy future. I would, as I move to some prepared remarks here, want to first acknowledge the National Academies and their recent report. This is going to be very, very important to us in the Congress, the America's Energy Future report. And we need insight. We need advice. We need the kind of work that the Academies has done on such an ongoing basis. And I don't know if the Academies are a hidden gem. Certainly one of the reasons that I think we all look to you is you found a way to exist above the political cacophony that happens to characterize what happens here in Washington, D.C. I've also got two of my very adept staff people with me and would like to point them out to you all. Wendy Adams is back here, and then Matt Bowen, who actually worked on the National Academy's report that I just mentioned to you all. I also want to thank the DOE for hosting the event, and I think we have Colorado State University here. Is that right? Yes. All right, the Rams are in the house, and I'm certainly a homer when it comes to wanting to acknowledge the great work that goes on in my state. I really believe in the Congress have to move a comprehensive energy package to the President's desk this year. We are in the 21st century. We need a 21st century energy policy, and we have to begin this transition away from a fossil fuel economy, taking nothing away from fossil fuels and the important role that they play. But we have to move, I believe, quickly and with some focus. And there's not a silver bullet here. We have the Coors Company in Colorado, so I want to give them their shout out. But there may be silver buckshot. There's a lot of ways in which we can try and hit the target. There's no panacea, but in many parts of our country, solar is going to play a key role in our future energy policy, our future energy technologies, and you all know that. And I think you know why. Number one is the economic implications and the economic opportunity that present themselves to us, and national security. And if I might, let me just talk about the economy first. We can clearly create millions of new jobs here in America and provide one of the key pillars of our economy in the 21st century. The president has spoken to this opportunity. I think that's why many of you are here. You can envision what this would involve. It'll spur innovation, and it will, as I've said now a couple of times, create a pathway to whereby we're producing clean energy here on our domestic shores. But all the talk doesn't necessarily convince people, right? And I want to just share the Colorado example with you. I think some of you are familiar with what already happened in Colorado. We have an RES or an RPS, or I'm sure we may continue in the continuing process to look at the right kind of language that really attracts people, perhaps even change the terminology over time. But renewable electricity standard is now, I think, the most used term. I don't know if you know what happened in Colorado. In 1997, I was elected to the state legislature, the one and only term I served there, and then I was demoted to the United States Congress. But I introduced, it was one of my five bills. You only had five bills in the Colorado legislature. That's the bad news. The good news is every single one of them has a hearing, every single one of them has a vote, up or down. I got on this crazy jag, and I had a consumer disclosure for energy use. I had a net metering bill, and I had an RES bill. I couldn't even get my RES bill out of a committee that had 11 people on it. I got two votes. I didn't even hold my Democrats. And I was later told it was in a room about this size, but you couldn't hardly get in the room. The walls were lined with people. And I was later told I'd won a great victory that day. And I asked the individual who told me that why. He said, oh, the utilities showed up in person to kill your bill. Usually they do it in the back rooms. Well, others picked up the idea, including Republicans and Democrats. And we always fell a vote short in the legislature. We'd get out of the House and couldn't get out of the Senate or vice versa. So Lola Spradley, who was the Republican Speaker of the House in Colorado, and I teamed up in that 2004 election. We put a ballot initiative in front of the voters, which you can do in Colorado, traveled the state. People were surprised. She and I at one point were literally in bed together because we were traveling in an RV, and we held a press conference sitting on the bed. But we convinced the voters, along with a lot of other advocates, that this was a smart idea. The utility still didn't like it, but in the end, it became the first voter-approved RES. And it had a pretty modest goal, 10% by the year 2015, including a 4% carve-out of the 10% for solar. So solar was a very small part of it, the overall proposal. In fact, it was one of the reasons the utilities were against it, was they thought it was too big a number. But it became a complete success. Just in a few years, we reached that 10%. The legislature came back and overwhelmingly passed a 20% by 2020 standard. And since the RES was passed, the Colorado Solar Energy Industries Association has identified at least 1,500 new solar jobs. And that's just one state, and it's one type of renewable energy source. It was worth it. It took perseverance. It took fighting against the vested interest in the status quo, but we're very well served in Colorado. So here nationally, I've been working, I guess I can be modest and say I've been leading the fight, Clark, for the RES here in the Congress, both on the House side and on the Senate side. And although I don't think the RES that we'll eventually pass initially will be as strong as I'd like it to be, it's a big, big step. And as we implement it, I think states, all 50 states, will find that setting that kind of goal, which Americans are good at doing when we focus, will be a real godsend. The second reason that I think it's so important that we pass clean energy legislation this year is national security. I serve on the Armed Services Committee. And if we reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and we all say this, and we know it, intellectually. But we have to keep reminding ourselves this is a huge, huge step when it comes to our national security. Just think about the countries we depend upon right now for our oil supplies. The Iranians, the Saudis, the Russians, the Venezuelans, the Kazakhs. that's not a very friendly group, if you think about it. In fact, I quipped recently, I think the Kazakhs are the most aligned with us compared to the other four countries. But we spend an amazing amount of resources, time, energy, the opportunity costs in defending oil supply lines. But there's probably even a more direct tie to our national security, and that's our troops themselves and the daily stresses that they face in procuring and transporting the fuel and, frankly, the water that powers our forces. If you read the accounts of the attacks using IEDs in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, often those attacks are occurring in convoy settings when we're moving our supplies and our resources to our troops. So that's another reason to get this right. And as an aside, the military, as some of you know, is really working hard on the PV and solar power front because it's a form of distributed energy. They issue, in many cases now, small solar panels. There's even work on clothing, including solar technology. I mean, I think the list is very, very exciting. They know better than any institution the need for new energy supplies. So where does this leave us? As I said earlier, we have to pass, I believe, in the Congress and get to the President's desk a 21st century energy policy, hopefully by the end of the year. And I'm guardedly optimistic. You have to be in this town. I want to leave you with that hope and that vision. But look, you all know laws aren't the only answer to everything. And some of you know Ernie Moniz. Familiar with Ernie Moniz? He's an MIT professor. And he said, I want to quote him because this is a very meaty thing he said, Clark. He said, "The energy industry is a multi-trillion dollar per year, highly capitalized commodity business with exquisite supply chains providing essential services at all levels of society. This leads to a system with considerable inertia, aversion to risk, extensive regulation, and complex politics." And what that says to me is that if we're going to transform our industry here in the United States in the ways that many of us feel that are necessary and on a fast enough schedule, it'll take a sustained effort, local, state, and federal. And it'll also take new innovative structures like the partnerships that you all are going to consider here today. And I know that the particular focus is photovoltaic manufacturing partnerships. And what that involves, and again, I'm telling you what you already know, is how you do research more efficiently, how you lower manufacturing costs, and how you help solar companies across the valley of death, which involves getting to that commercial scale. Now, other industries have figured out how to do this, and I think their stories and the analogs implicit are useful. I think, Clark, you mentioned the semiconductor example is going to be here, and I bet they'll have some great insights for you all. And I know you'll probably discuss other ways for the federal government, state governments, and universities to play productive roles, and I did want to return to the Colorado experiment and some of the successes we've had in Colorado. We have a partnership called the Colorado Renewable Energy Collaboratory, and that's a research consortium that consists of the School of Mines, Colorado State University, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. I haven't bragged on the NREL yet, but I just said it, and the University of Colorado Boulder. So we have these four great institutions, and I think I pointed out Dr. Seitz is here from CSU, and I think that you'll hear more about our co-laboratory later. And it was created by the legislature, and it works not just with those universities in NREL, but with private sector groups as well, and it draws in other universities in the Colorado State Community College system as well. And anything goes as long as it's in the energy efficiency, renewable energy, clean energy space. And I think there's a lot of interesting developments. It's relatively nascent stage, but all in all, there's a lot of excitement behind the collaboratory. And as I begin to close my comments, it's clear to all of us that we're not the only country that's actively working to gain an edge here and be the first to generate real economic opportunity. The French minister, I want to read what he had to say, of sustainable development recently said that a new French solar manufacturing project would act as a magnet to draw further solar investments and green jobs to France. And there's no doubt that that sentiment's shared by a number of other countries. I was just in Afghanistan, Clark, in Pakistan, getting a bird's eye view of and on the ground view of what's happening there. And we were in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and the UAE in general, oil producing states. Fascinating dynamic there, even though, in this regard. Dubai was competing for the International Renewable Energy headquarters. And if my sources are right, I think Abu Dhabi actually won that site. So here you have oil-producing emirates that also know that in the long run, renewable energy is going to be a key part of the world's energy systems. So I know that we can compete. I know that we want the clean energy manufacturing base here in the United States. We want to be selling the technology to other countries and not vice versa. So your gathering here today is an important part of this effort that we're undertaking. I have been saying that, and I borrowed this fair and square from Tom Friedman, that green is the new red, white, and blue. I work hard, frankly, to make sure that I'm not captivated all the time by Tom Friedman, because he can be wrong, believe it or not. And I've told him so. But we can't do anything, I think, more patriotic than driving the manufacturing, the products, and the leadership role that this new clean energy space presents to us. So I look forward to hearing about what you decide today, what you uncover, and learning more about the work you're doing. And I hope you'll continue also to weigh in, petition your government, push us in the Congress, push us in the Senate to continue to work on this, because frankly, I don't think there's anything more important facing our country today. Thanks for having me, and Godspeed, and enjoy each other, and come up with some great work product for us to consider. Thank you very, very much. Thanks.
Okay, I'm just going to bring your presentation up.
I have the privilege of introducing again our next speaker, Representative Gabriel Giffords of Arizona. And we're pleased to welcome her today. Her career also has been bathed in sunshine. She is a tireless advocate for the solar industry, and we're fortunate to have her with us today. In what we hope are just the early years of her service in Congress, Representative Giffords has demonstrated her effective commitment to supporting the solar industry. Combining her roles as a member of the House Science and Technology Committee and Vice Chair of the Sustainable Energy and Environmental Coalition, she has taken a leading role in promoting energy independence and the development of a strong solar industry in the United States. Her legislative efforts have included successfully promoting increases in solar research and development, training for solar workforce, and extending the investment tax credit. She has advocated incentives for solar power and government industry partnerships to demonstrate advanced photovoltaic technologies. A very impressive set of accomplishments for her work this in the Congress. So we're very delighted to have you here today. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. Chuck, thank you again for asking me back. It's always good when you're asked back. I was delighted to also see Mark Udall here. I serve in Mark's father's old seat, former Congressman Mo Udall. So it's a delight to be here, and I'm really hoping for an exciting day with good discussion. What I like about having a chance to travel and in the United States Congress, I serve on three committees. I serve on the Armed Services Committee, where Mark and I actually serve together, also Science and Technology, and also on the Foreign Affairs Committee. But what's so interesting about being abroad is that in most other places in the world, people ask you not what you do, but where you're from. So I wanted to start today with where I'm from, a place that I'm very proud of, what I would argue is one of the most beautiful parts of the country. And I represent the 8th Congressional District in that far southeast corner. Now, a lot of people think that my passion for solar energy comes just because we have a lot of sun in Arizona, which is true. But to show you the map that we're all so familiar with, the United States is really abundant in solar energy. I think obviously not just the state of Arizona, which clearly has the fortune of such a concentration of sunshine, but when you think about the world leader in deployment of photovoltaic technology and solar, which of course is Germany, you compare it to Anchorage, Alaska, or the state of Alaska. I mean, this map is so powerful because it really shows how the United States has this tremendous potential to lead when it comes to solar. It was great following Senator Udall because he did talk about a couple of the factors that we work on collectively and individually as members of Congress. There are three things that I think about every single day when I go to work, the three most important things that drive my agenda and I think should drive the United States Congress agenda. Our dependence on foreign energy, why we end up where we end up, and the resources that we need in order to fuel our economy and how we go about assuring those resources. Climate change, what's happening with global warming and the instability that could lead to our nation, it's real problems and the global problems. And of course, what's happening in terms of decline in our economy and our lack of economic competitiveness. Again, the great thing about solar energy is it provides a very elegant solution to these three critical problems. Energy independence, pulling and weaning our use of foreign energy, stabilizing our climate, slowing down what's happening with global climate change, and then this other area, which is a little more nuanced, but economic competitiveness and what's happening with our economy and making sure that kids get excited about this new type of technology and making sure that we can build a future full of renewables. So that's the good news. Now, what's so interesting is that we are not alone in recognizing this tremendous economic potential. The United States, yes, has historically been a leader in innovation for solar and for photovoltaics, but now we have lost that advantage when it comes to solar manufacturing. I want to figure out how we're going to reverse that trend, and a lot of what the discussion coming from today will hopefully result in is how we can bring that manufacturing back home here to the United States. According to the EIA at the DOE, peak electricity usage in the United States was 782 gigawatts. Now, looking at what portion of that actually came from PV, well, according to SEIA, the estimates is that last year that we installed about 342 megawatts, which brings us to a total of about 1.5 gigawatts installed in the United States. Of course, with the 342 megawatts, that's the rated capacity. So if we generously assume that the average output is 20% of that, we might actually just be generating maybe 68 megawatts on average, and probably less. Now, last year, the DOE issued a report outlining how the United States could possibly generate 20% of its power from wind by 2030. Now, let's assume a target like that for solar energy. What was it going to take to achieve that? Well, here we are in 2008. You can certainly see the progress that we've made from 2000 to where we are currently. But when you look at the growth actually needed, that would have to require 2,200 times the PV installed in 2008. We're not even on the chart. We don't even register where we have to get to by 2030 if we're going to achieve that 20%. I want to talk about the political challenges. It's what we have to do a lot. Unfortunately, we're the skinny guy. We look at other types of traditional energy sources. They're the big folks. When coming to looking at according to the Center for Public Integrity, when asked about self-identified climate lobbyists, 1 out of 10 actually identified them as someone that folks were interested in renewables. And something that's more challenging in itself, and again, I just wanted to prepare you for what we are up against. Looking at just one quarter of 2009, and we're not even talking about a campaign or an election year, but to give you a snapshot, the American Petroleum Institute spent $1.9 million for the first 3 months. BP spent $3.6 million. Marathon, $3.4 million. ConocoPhillips, $5.9 million. Chevron, $7 million. ExxonMobil, $9.6 million. Pulling out the coal energy annual budget, because we couldn't break it down by the quarter. This is the happy coal. Happy because they spent $45 million on their lobbying and political efforts. Now where are we? Well, the wind industry spent $1.6 million, and sadly, SEIA, our solar effort, is $410,000. This is what we are up against. Now, I'm not putting this up so we get discouraged, because obviously with very little resources, the solar industry has plowed ahead and made tremendous strides. But we have to figure out, because we are smarter than these folks, of how we are going to get this technology out there, installed, and really making a difference for our country and for our world. So we need to organize. We need to advertise, and we certainly need to educate. Now, I, as a relatively new member of Congress, I know that the solar resource in the United States is more abundant than the fossil resource. I know that it is technologically and economically feasible for solar to be a major power generator. And I know that solar is in the best national interest. But many of my colleagues that serve with me on Capitol Hill don't know this, don't understand it. It's not even that they don't believe. It's like the information is not even there and available. So they need to talk to you. They need to talk to your constituency. They need to talk to your employees. They need to talk to folks in your world, because that is one way that we are going to seriously influence the process. We need better coordination, and we need better communication. Now, most solar companies, probably many in this room today, are busy competing in terms of technology. Who's got the best technology? And that's great. But the reality is that we need to work together. I mean, every solar company in this room and across the world takes a backseat when it comes to fossil fuels. SEIA is working very hard, but clearly they need help. Plus, again, all of the renewables, when it comes to facing up the big guy against the little guy, we're the little skinny kid when it comes to facing fossil fuels. So education is a really key part of this. What can one member of Congress like myself, just a snapshot of some of the stuff we've doing, we got a whole bunch of community leaders. We went out to Nellis Air Force Base to see the incredible grid that they have, array that they have out there, and how that is functioning for the United States military and for the community up there. We do Solar 101. That's me at a public library almost every month having a chance for free seminars on how the average consumer can go about transforming their home or their business as well. We have a solar hot team, which we started to coordinate solar activities around the state of Arizona, because these large western states sometimes have an issue from northern part to southern part. So we do this weekly collaboration that has been very important to understand what's happening from a policy standpoint and from a technology standpoint. Also introduced legislation. When I first got here, I'm continuing to work on legislation to move this forward. Bottom line is we have a lot to do. And some of my frustration when I've come here to Washington talking to some of the tech folks is that a lot of folks come out of the Silicon Valley, come out of the computer side of things, which is great. I mean, it's great having that background. But when you're going up against the fossil fuel industry and traditional types of way of getting energy, I don't think anyone has, with just a background in the computer side of things, understands the challenges of going into these very traditional markets, where regulations take place at the state level, at the local level, at the federal level, where the lobbyists are enormous, where it's not just about price, it's not just about the best type of technology, it's about culture, it's about politics, and it's about figuring out ways to get into the system to really make the change necessary. So I just wanted to give you my perspective as a newer member of Congress on what we need to achieve, and I just want to thank you for having me, and I look forward to our panel.
Thank you very much, Congresswoman. Your enthusiasm was wonderful, and we applaud you for your support to solar. I also thank Chuck for giving me this opportunity to talk to you here. I'm from United Solar of Onyx, and what you see on the screen to the left is the world's largest rooftop system. This is a 12-megawatt rooftop system in a GM manufacturing plant in Zaragoza, Spain, and our laminates power the humongous warehouse manufacturing plant that they have there. Our products are lightweight and flexible, which I'm going to talk about a little later on, but because it is lightweight, we aspire even higher. Rather than putting on rooftop, you see here the Zephyr airship, which set a record for lasting the longest in the stratosphere using solar energy. And in the wing of the airship, you will see our solar laminates. A little bit about our company. We are a wholly owned subsidiary of Energy Conversion Devices. We are the world's largest manufacturer of flexible solar cells. We have a unique roll-to-roll process by which we make our solar cells, which I'm going to touch upon a little later on. And we are small. We have manufacturing plants in Michigan, and we employ about 1,000 people. But we have been growing quite fast. If you go back 5 years, 2003, we shipped less than 5 megawatt of products in 1 year. Last year, we shipped more than 100 megawatt. That's a factor of 20 growth. As I said, that we make flexible products, and basically our products are quite different from what you see usually. Typically, when you see the roll there, that's the 18-foot laminate. We put an adhesive at the back, we put a release paper, we can ship it to the site, we can remove the release paper, and we can stick it on the roof. So it gets rid of a lot of installation cost. So that's one advantage that our products are having. Since this program is about innovation and how do you take innovation to commercialization, I think it'll be worthwhile to talk about our history. I told you that we make our products in a very unique way. It's a roll-to-roll process. We take a roll of stainless steel, and it goes through certain machines where magically various layers of the solar cell are deposited. The first prototype machine we built more than 25 years ago in 1981. In 1986, we made our first prototype plant, 500 kilowatt per year. And in 1991, we built a plant of 2 megawatt capacity. Those days, amorphous silicon, the technology that we practice, was an unknown entity. People didn't know how the products are going to work. We sent some products to National Renewable Energy Lab. And lo and behold, they measured, they said, surprising, the product performs as per spec. What is good is that during the last 20 years, they have continued to measure these products, and it has given us and our customers a lot of confidence that using this new technology, you can have a reliable product which is going to last 20, 25 years. Around the same time, we also started developing some new technology in terms of triple junction solar cell, which I don't want to discuss very much. Using that triple junction solar cell, which can give higher efficiency, we built our first 5 megawatt production machine in 1996, and that was the first triple junction processor. It was around that time we thought that since we make flexible products, we can think of some unique application. That is the building integrated photovoltaic. That's what I talked about, that we make a flexible product and it can be directly applied to the roof. In 1997, we've made our first BIPV demonstration, and with the market acceptance, we grew steadily. In 2003, we built our first 30-megawatt production line. Some of you have come and seen the thing. It's really remarkable. We take 6 rolls of stainless steel, each 1.5 miles long, and in 60 hours, we make 9 miles of solar cell. Today, we have expanded further, and we have about 180 megawatt of capacity, annual capacity. During this time, the world has not stood still. The world market has grown up steadily. You see, in 2004, the world market was about 1,000 megawatt. In 2008, it was more than 5,000 megawatt. And you see, the remarkable growth has taken place in the last 3 years, from 2006 to 2008. What created that growth? That's the incentives that are being given by many countries of the world. The Congresswoman talked about the market in 2008. Out of the 5,000, 6,000 megawatt that was sold worldwide, only a little more than 300 megawatt was sold in the United States. So you can see that a little country like Germany, they had 4 times the deployment of photovoltaic than the entire United States. One of the things that one would like to talk about is that at this point in time, and I'm going to touch upon that a little more, we are not quite competitive with the humongous 2,000 megawatt thermal power station. And that is the reason why incentives are being offered by various countries of the world. You look at Germany, they give 41 cents to 51 cents per kilowatt hour incentive. You look at France, for ground-mounted system, they give about 40 cents a kilowatt hour. For building integrated, they give about 70 cents a kilowatt hour. Why are they giving these incentives? The reason they're giving incentives is that they want bigger deployment of photovoltaic. Many of the incentives have a downward scale. That is, incentives go down every year by a certain amount. What it does is that because of the incentives, people build larger manufacturing plant, they get better economy of scale, so the cost starts coming down. And why is it there is more incentive for rooftop solar system? You know, in many urban areas, you don't have enough vacant place, and you certainly do not want to put humongous PV installations in green parks. Roof is a terrible thing to waste, so what many people do is that they put PV on the roof, encourage that, so that you can have electricity generated right in the house. One of the interesting things that we all know is that deploying 100 megawatt of PV to electrify 200 commercial buildings, think of any commercial building which takes only 500 kilowatt, you can create 2,400 green jobs. Hermann Scheer, who was the father of the PV incentive program in Germany, he visited us last year. He was telling us that, you know, Germany used to be the auto capital of Europe. All the large automotive industries were in Germany. Today, PV employs more people than the auto industries employ in Germany. PV has created 180,000 new jobs. And Germany, mind you, has no more sunlight than my state, Michigan. So if they can do it in Germany, I'm sure it can be done in every state in the United States. I have touched upon the fact that we are not cost competitive yet, but the price is coming down. When you think about the solar electricity, you know, you talk in terms of cents per kilowatt hour or dollar per kilowatt hour. You see here how the price of solar electricity has been coming down over the years. You see the large span, because for the same cost, electricity can cost you more in a state, in a place where there's less sunshine. In 1990, the solar electricity was between 40 to 80 cents per kilowatt hour. Today, we have come down quite a lot, and in some places, we are already cost competitive with conventional electricity when there is a peak rate there. So according to the sources of Solar America Initiative, DOE things, in some places like in sunny California, we can generate electricity at 20 cents a kilowatt hour. We are just there. You know, for many residential users, the time of the day pricing, they have more than 20 cents a kilowatt hour. But we still have to go down further. I mean, you talk to any PV manufacturers, what we would like to do is that we don't want to depend on subsidy. We want to stand on our own feet. We want to reach grid parity. And we have shown that we can make progress, and we are on a path to reach grid parity. So we talk about how do we reduce the cost of PV. You know, when you think about the cost of PV, you have to follow the entire value chain. You know, you make the solar cell, then you make the module, which are interconnected solar cells. You make the PV array. You need PV converts sunlight to DC electricity, so you need inverters and other things. And finally, you sell it to the customer. So you have to hear the voice of the customer. So when we think about R&D, it really, the technology pipeline has to cover the whole value stream. You can't just work on materials. You just can't work on solar cells. You have to have the big picture in your mind. What does the customer want? You talk to an average customer, he or she will say, you know, I want to know how much money I'm going to spend to put the PV on my roof and how much electricity I'm going to get over the next 20 years. That's the cents per kilowatt hour. And I think in any innovation that we do must focus on that, how to reduce the cent per kilowatt hour that the customer pays to use the solar electricity. What should the government do till grid parity is reached? Demand creation is important, and many people will talk about that. One of the things I want to mention is that you can do the greatest technology, but if you do not have a demand base in the country, you are not going to create the manufacturing jobs. You see announcements, U.S. companies setting up plants in Europe, in other places. Why? Because the demand is there. So one of the things that we have to make sure that this 350 megawatt annual demand is not going to foster the growth of industry in U.S. So we have to have the demand creation. We have to remove barriers. We talk about codes. We talk about net metering. But when you talk about the R&D to reach grid parity, I think here I have a bone to pick. We talk about disruptive technologies. We talk about, you know, we have to do something new. We have to think out of the box. We have been thinking out of the box. We have been practicing disruptive technology. If we have not been doing that, we would not have achieved the cost reduction that we have achieved already. So, you know, we have to build on the foundation that we have established. I'm not opposed to doing something new because there's no silver bullet. There are many, many choices. But let's give credit where it is due. What the industries have done in terms of reducing the cost is phenomenal. And they are going to continue to do that. And there will be many other challenges that the more established technologies face, and there will be challenges where the new technologies which are going to face. You know, when you think about the government support, I borrowed this slide from Joe Morabito, and it has some of the DOE figures also. When you think about how government funding has come to support PV, initially there was focus on components. I see Ken Zweibel in the audience. I mean, he was instrumental in supporting and initiating the Thin Film Partnership, which was a unique example how industries, academia, national labs, they can work together towards a common goal. And trust me, it was not easy. When you talk to the academia and you tell them from the industry, you know, this is what you should work on, and they would tell you, who are you to tell me what I'm going to work on? But slowly, we accepted each other, and it was a wonderful experience when you see a bunch of people with very diverse background. They work together toward a common ground. But slowly what was understood was that the focus on components is not good enough. We have to work on a system-driven approach. We have to work on the end goal, which is how do we reduce the cost of electricity? And that is what the program started in terms of the Solar American Initiative by DOE. For the first time, people didn't talk about how do you increase the efficiency of a solar cell? How do you increase the efficiency of an inverter? the focus was how do you reduce the cost of electricity? And they encouraged to continue the trend to work with, to have a collaboration between industries, academia, and the national labs. I'm just giving an example. I mean, you don't have to put too much focus on that. When we submitted the proposal in 2006, the install cost was about $5.60. We said 2010, we are going to go below $4.50. And it's not just us. Many other industries had a similar program. And I'm proud to say through this initiative, many of us have exceeded the goal. And the task, the goal is not over. We have to continue, and we have to get to the 6 to 8 cents per kilowatt hour we're talking about. While we are talking about cost, while we are talking about the technology, we must not lose sight of the main focus. Clean electricity is not a choice. It is a necessity. We cannot afford to pollute the world. We cannot afford to emit greenhouse gases. So I many times quote Edith Hamilton, who is a famous historian. She said, in the end, more than they wanted freedom, they wanted a comfortable life, and they lost both comfort and freedom. When the Athenians wanted not to give to society, but for society to give to them, when the freedom they wished for most was freedom from responsibility, then Athens ceased to be free. We can't afford that. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here to say a couple of things. So I'm going to run through a couple of views of the industry perspective and where we think this thing is heading. The picture up there, by the way, is a picture of an installation that we have out in Nevada. That's an example of the type of installation that's becoming possible now. Okay, so. I want to just make a couple of comments at a sort of really high level in terms of where we think we're heading. So the IPCC has talked about a 5 terawatt renewable goal for 2020. And I didn't actually steal your slides, but this is the same message. So the same message over again. If you think about the growth rate you need to sustain from the current industry to get even closer to that goal. So even if you only want PV to be a small component of that goal, then you have to grow at an astonishing rate. I don't believe that any industry hitherto has sustained this kind of growth rate, a 70% compound annual growth rate over this kind of clip for this kind of time frame, right? So I think the question for us is not whether PV will grow from its current base, whether it's going to be successful as a commercial enterprise. The question really is, how big a piece of that ultimate energy mix do we want it to be? And what can we do to try to make it play the biggest possible role? Because I think if you look at the societal solution, I think you want to have an option to have a significant component of solar energy within that mix. And I think that's loosely what we're here talking about. But I want to remember how big the challenge is. Okay, so just a couple of things in terms of the scale of the industry. I think we still tend to talk about the PV industry like it's a juvenile industry. It's still in a very early stage technically, but this has become a real industry, right? So at this point, First Solar, for example, is at gigawatt scale. So the factory that I'm showing up there, this is an 800 megawatt factory out in Malaysia. This factory is fully operational now. We've grown to we did over $1 billion in revenue last year. So again, there are some real scales there. We talk a lot about the manufacturing cost number again. So people talk about a long-term goal of hitting grid parity. At this point, this is an audited financial result from last quarter. So this is in our audited financials last quarter of 93 cents a watt manufacturing cost.
So this is not a claim. It's not a goal. This is last quarter's actuals. There's a couple of messages that I want to make sure that people hang on to here. So first is, if you hit reset and you start again from scratch, then that 70% compound annual growth rate has to be a lot bigger, right? So if you start with a new technology, then you've got to do a lot more than 70% compound annual growth rate if you want to intercept the 2020 or even the 2030 goals, right? So you really need to start with an industry that's got a baseline now, and so if you want to hit that goal, you want to be incrementally improving based on technologies that leverage at least the infrastructure of our current industry. Right, so this is a plea for incrementalism here. Right, so we have a technology that's in hand. I'm showing First Solar because I'm from First Solar. There are a number of other companies in this room that have comparable cost improvement targets and comparable expansion targets, and it's my expectation that there will be multiple companies that will be able to achieve this kind of cost and this kind of scale in a very short period of time. Right, so again. It's a plea for incrementalism. There's an industry out there. The industry is driving pretty successfully, I think. We're driving forwards. We have a solution in hand. The cost point that we have gets us to where we think we need to be in terms of driving to the 2020 goal. Let's keep on pushing that direction forwards. The other place, by the way, where we do manufacturing is in the state of Ohio, right? So we're combining job creation in an imploded economy with our marketing and our headquarters are down in Phoenix, so we're also combining those two goals that you talked about earlier. Okay, and then again, in terms of grid connected, this is a picture of actually the same installation. So this is a 10 megawatt installation. It's located in the state of Nevada, but it actually is connected to the feed into California. So this the electricity off this power plant is feeding into the state of California. And it's a pretty decent sized array at this point in time. And if you look at our ability now to do multiple installations at this scale, we have a fairly significant contribution, even at today's scale. Okay, so again, the plea for incrementalism. Right, so the reason why we were able to achieve that cost is because we didn't change the technology every couple of years. So this is an ongoing improvement activity. This is the kind of thing that's very boring to the academics on the whole, but it's very critical for an industry. Right, so this is it's regular old learning. It looks like yield learning in a semiconductor line. It's cranking the handle and grinding on continuous improvements, and it's a very key piece again of why you want to stick with things that leverage existing production platforms. And here's the cost learning, right? There's a significant piece of cost learning, and this is showing the ongoing improvements over the last few years in our costs. Again, I don't want to get hung up on First Solar here. We happen to be maybe first out of the gate, but my expectation is that multiple companies in this room are going to drive down a similar cost curve. So I know that many companies here are already driving cost curves that are like this but a little behind, right? So again... ongoing improvement, if you look at how fast the rate of improvement is and you say, is there a need to leap to a disruptive technology? Do you have to jump onto a new technology? I think there's a clear assessment on my part that you don't need to radically reinvent the technology in order to get where we need to be. Now, just so we're clear, that's not to say that we should not be investing in long-term R&D for inventing the new technology that's going to be brought into manufacturing in the year 2020. We need to do that as well, but I think it's very important for us to have the investment in these more incremental technology improvements. Okay, and then this is our projection of a cost reduction roadmap, and so at this point we're projecting that this technology drives us down to about 52 cents a watt at the module level, and we have a comparable roadmap on the balance of systems side where we were able to drive this thing from the BOS standpoint, and you add those two things up and you have a business plan that gets you to where you need to be in terms of grid parity. Okay. Again, maybe so. It's another important point, right? So these improvements from an industry perspective, a lot of this is about it's turning the handle, right? So it's continuous learning, where you crank up the volume and you edge down the cost curve, and that's going with the installations as well as with the module manufacturing. Okay. So where do we cross over? And I guess a bunch of people talk about where's the actual crossing, the crossing point. I think if you look at the various cost points out there, we're already significantly under gas peakers, which is reflected directly in this peak price of electricity number that the last speaker just talked about. So where's the right cost point for this? Well, obviously, it depends on how sunny it is, and it depends on what you think is the appropriate price to put on carbon, amongst other things, right? So there's a certain amount of indeterminacy here. One thing that's very relevant in terms of when you think about the renewable energy writ large, right? The fundamental value proposition of renewable energy is I'll sell you the panels now, you'll get free electricity for the rest of your life, right? That's the basic value proposition, which means it's very intimately tied to the cost of credit. And so the financing piece of this should not be underestimated, and the role of loan guarantees or other mechanisms for driving the cost of financing is very, very significant in terms of how it drives the end user adoption here. The crossing point of grid parity is, to a large extent, going to depend on the cost of capital or the interest rates in the market. Okay, so the market, right? So again, this is our pipeline. This is the first solar pipeline, U.S. only. We project a pretty significant growth out there. But if you look at the times that we're projecting, those dates are relatively pushed out, right? So we're projecting big markets. We have a pipeline of projects out in the 2013 timeframe. These are projects which are already under discussion with utilities. And you may ask why this is so delayed. And one of the reasons is this: the permitting cycle and the overall development pipeline is extremely long. So again, if you're saying writ large, maybe not for this room, but writ large, where is there a need for government support in terms of driving this industry to where it needs to be? Government support in streamlining the permitting process, in simplifying the rules and regulations, a national RPS, right? So there's a whole slew of things that will make a very significant difference to the duration of these permitting cycles that will allow people to implement technology much faster. Okay, so that's sort of the U.S. Again, I want to maybe emphasize that when we look out there, so we're obviously talking to everybody in the world. Where do we think this market goes? I think it's already very clear that the market is going to follow the manufacturing, and the technology is going to follow the market. And I think a number of people have already said this, but there's a very clear pull. Couple of things drive it. So first is the need to work with the regulatory agencies and so on in whatever country the market is, and so that drives a need to have a presence in that country. And then the other thing is freight, which people don't talk about. But if you think about the way the glass manufacturing industry works, the glass manufacturing is almost invariably done in the geography where it's going to be installed, because the cost of freight, at some point, the cost of freight becomes a big piece of my total module cost. So cost of freight is a number that I track, and as I try to drive it downwards, I already have a barrier importing product into Europe out of Malaysia. There's a significant piece of freight. So ultimately, long term, where does this go? The market is going to drive where the technology is going to reside. Okay, this basically says the same thing. So quick sort of walking through the sort of policy issues around here. So working from the left, you know, R&D. I think there's a clear need from the industry standpoint. Again, I mentioned this for R&D. I would put it into two buckets. There's long-term R&D on new technologies that we want to see be implemented by the industry in 2020. And then there's a very critical set of R&Ds in terms of understanding the basic materials, physics, and so on, of the existing technologies. I think people typically don't separate those two things, but that's a very important separation to kind of bear in mind. A difference maybe from the semiconductor industry, right? So in the PV industry, the typical metric is going to have a rather lower number as a percentage of revenues. So the percentage of revenues that's going into R&D in the PV business is significantly lower than the semiconductor business, which is where I used to work. Okay, commercialization. There's this sort of intermediate phase where you're commercializing. I think there's a clear potential role there, but I think you need to be careful with the role there, because in that middle bucket, you have to figure out how you can stimulate that event without getting into the business of picking winners. And I think most of us would agree that in that commercialization phase, you don't want the government to be the responsible for picking winners. So you have to figure out how you can construct a program that isn't going to say the Department of Energy has decreed that this is the best technology. So you really need to have it driven out of the marketplace somehow. And then scale up again. You know, once you're in scale up, the critical piece is to develop the programs that will pull from the market. Okay, So I kind of want to draw the usual flow backwards. So usually we think of this thing, and I'm a technologist as well, you think of this thing sequentially. You start with R&D and you work your way through to the end market. If you think about how you want to structure the incentives, you kind of want to work that whole thing backwards, where you want to begin with market creation. Right? So if you start with R&D and you work all the way through, and then you don't create the market at the end, then all you have is a train wreck. Right? So you really want to think about starting from the market creation side and then having that whole thing pull through from the other side. And that allows the kind of system thinking that Subhendu was just talking about, where you have a system level thinking, is automatically driven by this. So all of the things that we're talking about trying to drive, it comes automatically if you pull it through from the market side. Okay, again, you know, so R&D, the basic R&D components and some of those other things are clearly difficult for the industry to do by itself. Okay, so summarizing a few points, right? So the current PV technologies, I want us to bear in mind as we're innovating, let's bear in mind that the current technology base gets us to grid parity or close today, and it is improving very fast. Our expectation is that you can drive the existing technology base to a place where it can be successful. So you want to invest in continuous improvement pathways. The biggest barriers that the DOE can help drive are around permitting infrastructure and scale. I think, again, there's incentives and loan guarantees are a critical piece of this, so the cost of financing. From an R&D perspective, I think there's a significant piece with demonstration programs, so that's exploring diesel cogeneration, so PV and diesel cogeneration schemes, looking at integration of storage at these sort of megawatt scale installations. So there's a whole range of things on the utility side that currently you need to break down, because you need to go break down barriers on the utility side to figure out, they have to figure out how to use it. They've got to figure out how to connect this stuff to the grid. And so understanding the way that the different grid scale pieces interact is very, very critical for this. Talking about a sort of technology agnostic view, right? So that type of program, again, you can implement that kind of program without necessarily picking winners. Standardization, again, if you ask me where we want standardization, I don't think that this industry right now is mature enough to do many of the things that the semiconductor industry has done. I think right now we will struggle to build a large program that looks like Semitech, because there is not enough common ground in terms of the technologies. So there's a wide disparity of technology bases that are used by the different industries. So I think the critical thing for that type of program is to carve out the areas where there is common ground. I think there are some areas where there's clear common ground, and we need to figure out how to do that. And then the other difference from the semiconductor business is we're not ready for standards yet. So again, because there are very divergent technology platforms, it's extremely difficult for Unisolar and First Solar to sit down together and decide on common standards for how we want to transfer equipment, what's the common data interfaces, all those things that the semiconductor industry worked on. It's too early for that. So there's a range of things here that don't apply from the semiconductor business. But I think standardization on the permitting side is very critical. So understanding how you build standards on that system level side, that stuff is very critical, and it's very open, and it breaks down a lot of barriers. One last comment. So I think a number of people have talked about the NREL program and how the Thin Film Partnership program, what a great example that is. One other thing that's great about that was the way it handled IP. So I would urge people to think about the constructing a program as you explore industry partnerships. You need to figure out how to construct a program that allows industry to come to the table and direct the research towards the interesting problems while protecting that intellectual property, right? And that's a very difficult discussion to have with most academic institutions right now. And frankly, I don't work with most academic institutions for the intellectual property reason alone. So I only work with the ones that are prepared to work with that kind of framework. And I think people need to think about that as a framework as well. Okay, thanks.
Chuck says we have time for a couple of questions. Ken.
So I'd like to follow up on the discussion about incrementalism. And one of the things that I've learned since I've been here in Washington for a year or so is that there's a kind of a knowledge gap about today's technologies and their opportunities for improvement to reach very low-cost goals. And the idea of doing fairly basic research that might actually be blue sky research that might be 20 or 30 years away. I think what we've seen on the panel is representation that there's an awful lot of momentum towards very low cost goals. But I wonder whether you've experienced that disconnect in terms of how R&D is done or how R&D is funded.
Right. So, do I have to turn this on?
Just push it.
So I think I don't want to say that there's no value in disruptive device architectures, but I think most people tend to make the leap of assuming that if basic R&D is needed, what's needed is a radical new device architecture. So it needs to be a third generation nano technology, whatever, and I think there's enormous opportunity for basic research in driving the materials physics, the device physics of existing device architectures. In the same way as I think the semiconductor industry had a lot of great basic research in terms of understanding, again, the basic material stuff that was going on. And so I want to make sure that second piece doesn't get left out because it tends to get forgotten.
I think that has to be a healthy mixture of both. I am reminded that in 1875, the patent commissioner said that they should abolish the patent office because all the inventions have already been made. So we don't want to take that path. But I also don't want to take the path that whatever has been done cannot reach us to the golden goal. And I think we're going to get there. There has to be basic research. There has to be focused research. And I think some of the programs that DOE has been doing, and Ken, you are instrumental in some of those things, show that the academia and the industries can work together toward a common goal.
In terms of what the goal is, when I think about the goal, I think about 2020, 2030, what is the renewable share that PV can take. And so that's a goal. And if that goal was 2080, then it might make sense to have a larger ratio of investment in the more blue sky or longer term radical device innovations. I think that what makes this different for me is there's a very pressing, very pragmatic, near-term goal that we collectively as a community are all driving towards. And I would urge people to think about how short a time that is, right? It is not long. And so, again, I think there's an enormous amount of value to exploring the nanotechnology impact of these things. And I wouldn't want to forget that. And I want to have a new generation of devices to be available in 2030. But I think we as a country are going to make a big mistake if we think that that's all there is. And typically what I see out there is only the sort of third generation, next big leap kind of approach.
David, I just want to follow up with you. I've got to put, of course, my political spin on things, which is when the Congress was debating just a couple of weeks ago, the largest piece of legislation that we've ever looked at in terms of the cap and trade, the energy bill, where was the solar industry? I mean, when you looked at those committee hearing rooms and you looked at the lobbyists that were packed outside of those hearing rooms to make sure that they were protected, those of us that care about solar energy, and not just high-paid lobbyists, but all of us here in this room, the ability for us to come down and advocate for this technology was missing. So we have goals out there, which is terrific, but again, we are up against some pretty powerful forces when it comes to making sure that we're able to get there. Maria, go ahead.
I think you're first, yeah.
I don't think your mic's on.
Can you?
I wanted to follow up on the issue of standards and semantic. You are in a very good position, having been in workplaces to address this issue. Right now, we have fragmented technologies, we've got a bunch of different things going on, but we have a goal of this industry growing at 70% compound annual rate. Without standards, without some focused approach, how do we get there without spending tons and tons and tons of money? So I think, personally, I think there are needs for standards. Then the standard, maybe people like you can help organize this in the sense that which standards are needed now, which can be defined later. We need to prioritize, but we need to start now. Because if you look at the standards landscape for PV, it's a mess.
So clearly there are some standards that I think are critical, but there are some standards which it would be nice to achieve, but the industry is simply not mature enough to take them right now. Right. So again, thinking about SEMI, there's a collection of standards that begin with the wafer size, with the wafer handling equipment. And then spreads outwards from there. And I think there was also a very clear need for standardized interfaces between tools and those types of things. And I think the standards bodies played a huge role in helping the industry be successful. I think that's a laudable goal for us to think about long term, but this industry is simply not mature enough. There is no standard interface where you want to be able to put a steel roll into my glass handling equipment, right? And so the divergence, it's a purely practical issue, right? The divergence of technologies that are happening out there means that the industry is just not ready to take on board that kind of standard thing. And there is the same issue with some of the pre-commercial R&D.
Okay,
we
have one more question. Okay,
just very quickly, you know, when you talk about standards, it's a new industry, but things are happening. Like we have the international standards, IEC 61646, which I believe is a very good step in terms of ensuring reliability of PV products. So there are good things happening.
Last question. Go ahead.
It follows up somewhat on that. Marie Mapes from the Department of Energy. You did mention, though, Dave, that there were some areas of collaboration that you could see amongst the various different parts of the industry, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. Both of you.
Before you. No, go ahead.
So I think there's examples in terms of basic research in device modeling, so basic device models that are shared between the different pieces of the industry, so optical modeling. There's areas in terms of TCO that is that again are common across multiple platforms. But they tend to be, so I think they tend to, the pre-commercial tends to be a step further back. It tends to be materials level or it's along those lines as opposed to being something like the semiconductor industry was able to establish pre-commercial programs in gate oxide reliability, right? And you, it's not going to be easy to get that kind of consensus within this industry because this industry is still burgeoning in all kinds of directions, which is its strength as well as its weakness.
I think I can take a lot of pride in the fact that in thin film silicon area, the work between industries, academia, and national lab, I think it is a success story. We have learned to understand each other's language. We have learned to understand, academia have found out that they can do exciting work, even though it is a focused work. And we have learned to understand that academia can help us. So if you track back as to starting from Thin Film Partnership to Solar America Initiative, we have worked with many, many universities in the United States and their stalwarts. And I think we have worked toward a common goal. The main issue is respect for each other. And once you develop respect for each other, you can achieve many things.
Thanks, everyone. And I think we're going to take a break. Is that right, Chuck?
That is right. Could we have a round of applause for a really outstanding